Good morning. It just feels too much like school. I can't do it. Good morning. It's so good to be here. It's so good to see you. Thanks for coming out today. Are there any guests or visitors who would like to introduce themselves now so we can know who you are and come and greet you after the service? Okay. I'd like to read a poem from Barbara Marx Hubbard for our opening words. It kind of summarizes today's theme. What is this flame of expectation, this growth impulse, this frustration that urges us to break through the given pattern of our lives? What pulls us as though by an irresistible magnet toward each other and toward a desirable yet undefined state of being? Over 13.7 billion years ago, over 13.7 billion years, it has continued to draw atoms to atoms, molecules to molecules, cells to cells, and now people to people in ever more complex systems. This flame is the radiant energy of love. It's more than our personal love for each other, one by one, and it's even greater than altruistic love for others. It is also, and more so, a transpersonal love, one that senses the fulfillment of one's self-concern through deep involvement in the evolution of the world in connection with the universal force. This flame is the attractive and attracted energy that moves the process, the intention of creation. It was ignited at the beginning of creation, and it became self-conscious at the dawn of humanity. It is now rising higher, kindled by the maturation of science as it probes the mysteries of the universe from without, and it's kindled by the deepening intuition of millions, attuning to reality from within, kindled by the dangers pressing upon our species as a whole. The flame of expectation is igniting us, animating and attracting us to move beyond our existing life patterns. It leads us to do more, to be more, to know more, and above all, to connect more with each other and to discover what we can do together that none of us can do isolated and alone. So let's turn to reading number 445, The Womb of Stars, and that will be our chalice lighting. That'll be our chalice lighting words. I could light them now, though. The womb of stars embraces us. Remnants of their fiery furnaces pulse through our veins. We are of the earth. We breathe and live in the breath of ancient plants and beasts.
Their cells nourish the soil. We build our communities and our ecosystems.
Our fingers trace the curves carved in clay and stone by forebears unknown to us. We gather anew this day to celebrate our common heritage. I don't see any announcements. I can announce that most of the children have gone to the gardens, I think, today, community gardens. So that's why they're not with us in the service. And other than that, please look in your order of service and your insert for the rest of the announcements. Our first hymn is number 304, A Fierce Unrest.
Thank you.
This is the time for sharing our joys and our sorrows. So if there's something you'd like to share with this community, the mic will be brought to you and you can tell us all about it.
Hi, Marilyn Caldwell. The dreaded day has come. Tomorrow I am having a cataract removed from my right eye. And it scares me, so all good wishes, all good thoughts will be appreciated. And hopefully I'll be back next Sunday and I'll be able to see out of that eye.
Springboger, my cousin got married yesterday to his wife Terry, so, and I was up late, but I managed to make it to the wedding, even though I got lost most of the way. Okay.
Morning, Kathleen Oldfather with the Caring Committee, and a couple announcements. First, I'd like to thank everyone that helped with the Kermser Memorial this week, and especially thank Thea for coming and helping us several times in the last week or so at Meadowlark, and then planning the memorial and officiating at it, and the many others that brought food and helped at the service. We really appreciate it. I know they're very grateful. And then another announcement that Jack Warren, a longtime member here who often sits over here and often plays music, is in the hospital. And he's had a hard time in the last 6-9 months, as you some of you know. And he kept falling, and so we sort of made him go to the hospital the other morning, Michael and I. And so he's doing better, but he'll probably be there for a while. And he would like visitors, but make them short visits because he gets tired. Anything else? Oh, that's right. I got called away from the memorial because of my mother, and she has 2 broken kneecaps. So it's changing their life considerably. Thanks for your support again at the memorial.
Thor's mom is coming to our house today.
My name is Gail Conrad. I've been away for a little while, but I want to share something that happened this summer. Just before I was to leave, I got a telephone call that no one ever wants to get. It was the police from Philadelphia saying, "We've just taken your son to the hospital. He had a heart attack. He's 36. And he did. It was ventricular fibrillation. That's stop. Many miracles happened after that, and I'm thrilled to report that he is doing absolutely fine now. I'd like to discuss briefly 3 miracles and ask your help in acting on these. The first miracle was that he had been riding for 45 minutes, and when this occurred, he was at the corner of a park, and when he collapsed in front of a nurse who was looking at him and knew CPR. And was not afraid to get involved and did it. Without that, nothing else would have mattered. The second miracle was that he was wearing a bracelet that had emergency numbers on it. His new wife of 5 weeks and mine. His wife was asleep because she just finished a 36-hour rotation in her residency, and so they got me. But if any of you do any long-distance sport of any kind, please wear a bracelet or a shoe tag or something, because every minute counts. The third one I was not responsible for, and that is, if you have someone far away, please have more phone numbers than theirs. I had Zach's and I had Maura's. I didn't have any of their friends. I had their addresses, but everyone has cell phone numbers now, and they're not on the white pages of the computer. Fortunately, Maura's mother had numbers that they could call, and so friends came to wake her up. Friends went to the hospital where they had taken Zachary, and other friends, and friends from Maine brought him immediate, fabulous medical attention. So it all worked out well. But be sure you have more phone numbers than just your loved one and their spouse or their significant other, because you never know when you may need them.
So this is the time for the offering. I'm not sure how to do that. Perfect preparation for our meditation. I invite you into a posture of prayer meditation. Craig Hamilton is one of the new evolutionary spirituality theologians, and this is from him. Choose an issue in your life where you feel stuck or where you're struggling. This could be a relationship issue, an issue related to your career, or an issue on your spiritual path. Allow yourself to connect with the core sense of stuckness or confusion of not knowing how to resolve the situation. Once you have a clear issue in mind, let go of it. Right now, in this moment, allow yourself to connect with the part of you that gets excited by change, the part of you that's happy when things don't go according to plan because it means something unexpected is going to happen. This is also the part of you that's interested in growth and evolution, the part of you that wants to make the world a better place. Now realize this part of you is not separate from the impulse of evolution itself. 13.7 billion years ago, this evolutionary impulse burst into existence, and it's been unfolding its creativity ever since. And now the leading edge of that creative unfolding is waking up in and as you. Allow yourself to become this evolutionary impulse itself, to step fully into it, to embody it, to discover what it feels like to be evolution in action. Now, from this expansive place, look at the issue you're struggling with. How does it look from here? Our reading is from another one of those young evolutionary spirituality theologians, Andrew Cohen. He's only 56, but he's been a spiritual teacher since 1986, having devoted himself to his spiritual education after an experience when he was 16. And the main spiritual teachers that he recognizes as similar for their times as he is for ours are Sri Aurobindo and Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. So this is a little segment of his description of principles around evolutionary spirituality. The first two principles of evolutionary enlightenment, he says, are purity of motive and integrity in action. These two principles are the ever untainted expression of the authentic self. Purity of motive is an egoless impulse, a wholesome passion to create what is new. It emerges only to the degree that the ego has been transcended. When the individual reaches that point where he or she aspires to become enlightened for the sake of the evolution of consciousness itself, this pure motive will naturally be experienced as a heartfelt connection to that higher purpose and potential. It cannot arise from the personal self or ego. Purity of motive is the feeling sense of the authentic self, the ecstatic compulsion to create the future. As profound an experience as it is, the mere awakening of a pure motive is not enough. Unless we act upon that egoless impulse, its presence in consciousness ends up being only another spiritual experience, a momentary glimpse of our own potential for a deeper care. Purity of motive must always be actualized so that it becomes integrity in action. That simply means that the individual consistently follows through on that purity of motive. And that takes a heroic spirit. For most of us, pure motivation arises in the heart thousands of times before it becomes an act of integrity that's expressed in the world. So when purity of motive is expressed in action with integrity, a person reflects the wholeness that created and is still creating the universe. We could call it living the evolutionary impulse. So one interesting thing about evolution is that whole species change one individual at a time. That's the little piece that Darwin added. There is a natural selection of individual beings in terms of changing into something new that enables them to survive or thrive in an ever-changing environment. It isn't competition. Nature's selection is for cooperation. Cooperation among all the changes that are always happening. A simple way of saying that is, nature selects for what cooperates best. Individuals within a species are changed by their context, by the cosmos, and the cosmos is changed by individual changes. Current spiritual thinkers are inviting us to imagine the human part of evolution and suggesting that we can make choices regarding the future of the cosmos. The proposition is we can evolve consciously by tuning in to our natural impulse to evolve. I'm finding myself persuaded by the possibility that our species is at a place where shifting from what has motivated us in the past to fresh motivations related to what's needed for our common future will lead to more flourishing for all. Again, not in competition, but as parts of one whole cosmos. Behind our worldview or perceptions of the world are some assumptions based on faith, and it's nearly identity shaking to have the faith assumptions that we don't even really think about, to have those faith assumptions challenged. But this evolutionary spirituality that I've been learning about has invited me to challenge two of my faith assumptions as needing updating. And here's my metaphor of the week. Last week, twice, I needed to update passwords in order for something new to happen. And I could not get those darn passwords out of their, you know, save this password line. So both times I had to call for help and go to cookies or whatever it was to get rid of the old passwords so I could put in the new passwords and something new could happen. So it made me think that it's a little bit like that. It's a little bit like having those assumptions somewhere behind us, those faith assumptions. And in order to get rid of them, we have to kind of shake things up and maybe call for help. But it's necessary to change the password a little bit. So two of my faith assumptions where evolutionary spirituality has shaken them up a little bit is, as a Gandhian, I always say that I try to be the change that I want to see in the world. This means that I give attention to my individual spiritual development in a way that kind of separates me from what I've come to recognize as a generally violent culture. The second one is I've often evaluated my ethical choices based on a positive response to the Kantian question, what if what I'm doing was something that everyone did according to universal law? This means my choice is so good that it's right for everyone all the time. Neither of these faith assumptions behind my worldview will work if evolution, when understood as co-creativity or cooperation for the good of the ever-changing whole, is the lens through which I see reality, especially the future. But my theological orientation is liberal, so I expect to have faith assumptions shaken every now and then. And I'd prefer to be shaken and have my worldview aligned with the best integration of science and cosmic stories than to hang on. We can't keep those old passwords forever. And it's really quite interesting to notice and imagine places where individual changes interface with cosmic change, where conscious choice might possibly influence the whole, and where the needs of the whole require reassessment of what we've considered our personal motive. Science has shown us that we need to make changes in how we live in order to sustain life on our planet. So what needs to change about our spirituality? Do we value the whole world's future enough to show that we do by directing our time and energy toward the salvation of the whole? So I'd like to share a couple of the ideas that persuade me of the value of evolutionary spirituality as a foundation for ethics in these times. When United Church of Christ clergy Michael Dowd and Unitarian Universalist science writer Connie Barlow travel around telling the great story, which is the common story of evolution as ongoing creation, I think they're living from a cosmocentric worldview. They're living for the sake of the whole world's future. They have faith that this great story, which could be called a creation story, offers a unifying theme for people of faith and people of science. Here's a one-sentence description of the great story from their website. In the course of epic events, matter was distilled out of radiant energy, segregated into galaxies, collapsed into stars, fused into atoms, swirled into planets, spliced into molecules, captured into cells, mutated into species, compromised into thought, and cajoled into cultures. All of this and much more is what matter has done as systems upon systems of organization have emerged over 13 billion years of creative natural history. So this is a pretty different creation story from what I learned in Lutheran Sunday school. It's big, it's majestic, but there's also some kind of space in there for my energy or for each of our energy. There's somehow a way of understanding it that allows it to be co-creative so we can be part of it. The term co-creation in this sphere stands for that flow from science to creation story to personal meaning. Okay, now a theological example of shifting toward cosmocentric centric attraction, reimagining enlightenment. In the recent past, we understood enlightenment as individuals seeking their personal salvation through character development, like being the peace you want to see in the world. And then we express our enlightened spiritual selves in dedicated capacity to heal. And this approach focuses on the individual developing themselves and then giving something of themselves to another individual, someone who needs them. Okay, the shift is that evolutionary enlightenment is not about individual development in the traditional sense. It's cosmocentric, or it's concerned with the salvation of everything. Its expression has to do with cooperation and giving rise to what will emerge next, again, co-creation. So you see the difference? Individual enlightenment, personal character development, personal help. And evolutionary enlightenment is doing it for a whole different reason, doing the work for the sake of the whole from the beginning, which puts a whole different twist on it. So we step into the adventure of saving each other, and then in evolutionary enlightenment, we see what happens to us. We might change in a way that we don't expect. We aren't in control of everything that influences us. So the responsibility in this way of understanding ethics is to have a pure motive, as we heard in the reading, a motive that aligns with what is a natural impulse for co-creation. We let ourselves be changed, noticing where we're going and whether a course correction is required. I'm not talking about passivity. But I am talking about responsiveness. In the character development part, it's a kind of discipline, an individual discipline. In the evolutionary part, it's responsiveness and being willing to be changed. And then another aspect of this is not being so sure that how we're trying to act with integrity is the right way for everyone. That's a pretty big shift, losing some of that certainty. Other people might have a part in evolution that we just don't understand, and it might be different than our part. So that's a pretty big shift. Kannapolis, Kansas resident and scholar Paul Crum has developed a values and growth schema that helps me tie some of these new ideas to something I've known before. And so he talks about four stages of a person's development, physical, emotional, mental, and then what he calls cosmic spirit. And he has values for each of these. So we're going to just look at the cosmic spirit values. He says cosmic spirit values are commitment, trust, understanding, respect, diversity, caring, fairness, the uniqueness of each individual, the connectedness of everything. The cosmic spirit values balance. The cosmic spirit values balance and looks at the big picture, the integrated picture, and recognizes interdependencies. The cosmic spirit values individual insights and the insights of our friends, neighbors, communities, prophets, and cultures, trying to understand that everybody's going to be coming from a different perspective. The cosmic spirit values rights and responsibilities moving together with decisions made on a functional rather than a power basis. And the cosmic spirit values the responsibility to stop people who are causing hurt and the corollary responsibility to promote growth without controlling. It values the means-ends relationship, recognizing that means and ends are inextricably entwined and that a chosen end does not justify any means. The cosmic spirit values mystery, accepting that we don't know everything while still valuing our reasoning ability. And the cosmic spirit values humility, which should be part of the consideration before action's taken. So to me, these cosmic spirit values are consistent with evolution. Awareness of them can be a bridge to cosmic, to conscious evolution. Philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who lived from 1844 to 1900, analyzed collective human history in three stages. And the first he calls the camel. The camel just sits there, moans, and takes it. The first four millennia of recorded history are the camel, according to Nietzsche. The second he calls the lion. The lion says no, no to power, no to tyranny, no to plague, no to ignorance. Western politics since 1776, or even since the drafting of the Magna Carta in 1215, can be seen as the uphill struggle to say no. And this has been working. What if the lion really worked? What if humanity could actually say no to successfully to all disabling conditions of life? What then? Nietzsche says there's a third stage of development, the child reborn. The child asks, to what can we say yes? What can every human being affirm? So Seligman in Flourish says we can all say yes to more positive emotion, more engagement, better relationships, more meaning, more positive accomplishment. We can all say yes to more well-being for the cosmos. So these stages can be related to how we engage with Earth's resources. Once people were afraid of forests, and they passively stayed away. And then some people decided to start cutting those trees, and the camel stage continued. Most people were passive. But for some decades, there were environmentalist lions saying no to unlimited forest destruction. And now we have the chance to see some of the people who are saying yes. Yes, we can have sustainable forests. People and forests can be on the same side, and we can reinforce each other's flourishing. So we've evolved to notice that human beings and trees are on the same side and that there is mutual interdependence. So it's possible to say yes when we're conscious and creative, when we're co-creating. And thinking about that reminded me of Henry David Thoreau. He's often associated with forests. He was born about 200 years ago, and I think he was tuned into the evolutionary impulse a little before its time. He lived in that purity of motive and that integrity of action, I think, partly because he lived at such a slow pace. He lived at a pace where his main activity was, you know, keeping his journal and taking a walk every day around Concord. But he also paid close attention. He was noticing everything. And when he made those daily walks, often twice daily around Concord, he wrote down exactly what it was that was happening in the forests. And so a couple, not that long ago, a few decades ago, we finally found his papers and reinforced the idea of forest succession. I guess these papers were in a trunk for a long time. So the biologists were just then getting to that point that Thoreau had observed by his meticulous recording of what happens day to day in a forest. So what he did, living in his simple way, which a lot of people wouldn't call a success, but I think he was paying attention to what would benefit all of us in the future. And I wish, you know, they could have identified that the papers were there, but it just took us a little while to get to them. But what he really did was he gave us a gift from the past that had to do with his way of approaching life, his slow, meticulous way. What blocks us a lot of times, what didn't block Thoreau, but what blocks us a lot of times when we're trying to put that beautiful list of cosmic spirit values into action is that we're in systems that disallow the values that we're trying to live or trying to express. I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but sometimes you just bump up against limits. I've been to a couple of nonviolent communications workshops, and the story goes that there was a whole public school where all the teachers had been trained in nonviolent communication, and they were going to try to teach the children, you know, from a very early age that if they were seeking, if they were paying attention to everybody's feelings and needs, they could have much better communication, their conflict would be less, and they'd be able to get along better. However, what happened was that the limits on the structure kept them from being able to use that method. There were too many structural limits for them to have nonviolent communication implemented in their school. So we have to then identify what needs to be changed, not only in the individual person, but also in the culture, not just the gene, but also the meme. Obviously, that's part of human evolution. Marshall Rosenberg, the founder of nonviolent communication, started telling his prospective teachers that in order to be certified, they had to figure out how to develop environments where nonviolent communication could be implemented. And he said, I sure don't know how to do that, but I need you to figure out how to do that. And that's when we'll be able to move ahead in this method of communication, when enough people are also working on the structures, on the culture. So it's huge. It's genes and it's memes. Ken Wilber says that what evolution is self-organization toward self-transcendence. He says it's the desire to get together that brought cells together in the first place, and it's that yearning for union that keeps life moving in the direction of greater complexity. So along with Barbara Marx Hubbard in our opening words, Ken Wilber says it's love that is the evolutionary impulse, the energy behind evolution, impersonal love. Love or evolution is a yearning to come together for the sake of something new for the future that pulls us into action. The way Cohen said it in our reading, a pure motive is an egoless impulse, which seems related to love, which is a wholesome passion to create what is new. So at least for me, it's difficult to imagine co-creating with such pure motives, but it is possible to imagine shifting a bit in that direction When I did Craig Hamilton's meditation for the first time, my issue had to do with being agitated about my contribution to a little project being ignored. Then when I looked at that project in the sense of what benefits the whole and tried to see it from that cosmocentric perspective, it got really small. It got to the appropriate size for an ego. So I think even if we can't imagine changing our whole motive, maybe we can imagine changing some of our small little motivations or concerns and trying to see them from a bigger perspective. At least that's the stage I'm in, trying to implement this idea. The task then is to get back in and keep trying, forgiving, expecting to be forgiven, and allowing the changes that come with co-creating. Again, not necessarily changes that we're in control of, changes that happen from the changes around us. So the new understanding of evolutionary enlightenment invites us to keep participating even when we can't control what's going on or how it influences us, and even if we don't know exactly how it's going to end up. Instead of seeking enlightenment, again, for our own salvation, we need a kind of impeccable honesty to face everything, even our most shadowy places, and take responsibility for what's motivating us, and then let go of that individual motivation and do it for the sake of the whole, do it for the sake of the future. So let me close with Hubbard's description of why this is the moment when humans can be conscious of evolution and make a choice to participate. She says, "It was just in the mid-1960s that scientists were able to identify background radiation and extrapolate backward to the first instant of creation." She said, "This discovery now allows us to place ourselves in the story as the story evolves through us. We recognize the cosmic evolutionary impulse through the inner impulse in each of us, motivating us to do more, be more, love more, know more, participate more in the service of others and society." So the evolutionary impulse, the motivating force behind billions of years of evolution, is active in each of us, and we can learn to recognize it as a motivator. Living from that kind of authenticity, that core evolutionary impulse authenticity, requires the support of like-minded souls, of spiritual allies, a community that's kind of leaning forward together. So it's good to be with you. So any thoughts?
I'm not dealing with the evolution, but I'm dealing with the cooperation. And my husband gave the most brilliant speech he ever gave to the engineering department here was to talk about the wooden desk, the paper, everything about us came from different countries, and how we needed to realize that we all had to work together.
The contradictions made me think of when I taught in a middle school for a couple of years, and that was in the 70s, and we were doing the same thing. We were studying nonviolent communication, and we had all of these workshops, and yet the school still paddled kids, and they saw no contradiction in that whatsoever. So it's what, words and deeds, and it's hard to make people see where there's a contradiction, like middle-class people voting Republican, I guess.
Once again, this is where I think we have things that we need to share beyond our own community, because it seemed to me that there's, if we really look at this idea of cosmic evolution as a spiritual path, and we compare it to what is being purported on television, all you have to do is turn it on any morning at 5 a.m. and hear Clef O'Dollar and his Gospel of Greed, or you can hear whoever the next one is. I mean, there's such a disconnect, I think, anymore in American spirituality between true spiritual beings and get-rich-quick schemes. And what I see this doing is that it's affecting broader societarial trends. The upcoming election for the Kansas State School Board will once again bring the issue of evolution and creationism up as scientific ideas. But what we don't realize is that the quality of education by those pushing creationism is a dumbing down to a point where people have they don't have the skill set needed to be able to differentiate fact from fiction. And, you know, I just see this as something that's sort of ongoing in our society, where we're continuously going spiraling downward rather than moving up towards the cosmos, so to speak. It's just some ideas I have, but you might want to comment on that.
Myself, I'm inclined very much to your perspective. Unfortunately, in the biology of evolution, competition does exist, and communities cannot stay stable unless there is some competition between them. On this wonderful island that we go to in Maine, the deer have no enemies anymore, and they're taking over the island. So we have to somehow, as we move toward sustainability, have a place for the right kind of competition, the right kind of dynamic, so that balance can be achieved. What we do about what you just mentioned, the overwhelming greed of some, I have no idea, but I wish I did.
Is there any wiggle room at all in that need for purity of motive? Let me give a hypothetical example, and that is working out for me a dress code. And what I stumbled onto many years ago was this criterion. What do I need to wear to get me what I want? Now, but if I want something that's good, not just for me, but for others, does that allow me to stay with that dress code? You can see what I have on today. I can't think of a thing I want from anybody in here, so I just dress for comfort. And matching colors. Well, you've read him. Is there anything in there that will help those of us who might want just a little room to work with there?
I'd like to talk about that because it's something I've been thinking about. This is something I've been thinking about for many, many years. Where did man decide to decorate himself? What made him clothe himself and then start to decorate himself? So I think all of these things can be right within the purity of motive. If your interest is beauty, practicality can also be a part of it.
I love how this has evolved. Let's see, at the beginning, without using too multisyllabic words, is this a big enough deal? You know, you just got to take the issue that's bothering you and because this happens all the time. Maybe just in the last couple hours, I've had some issues come up. On the dress code, my simple solution is, am I dressed at the high enough level to get what I want? And I hadn't made the same decision about coming to UU. There was nothing I really needed here except some spiritual and peace in my life. But when I'm in doubt, dress up. When I'm in doubt, dress up, Ruth. Yeah. Why do men adorn themselves? Well, first of all, why do we wear clothes? Because we moved out of the tropics into the northern regions. So, okay. Okay, why do we adorn ourselves has to do with sex, but I won't elaborate that, okay? And it goes for both genders. And if Scott were here or someone who can tell me who the quote, okay, he's a scientific philosopher or something, who said evolution is red tooth and claw? Anyway, it's not nice. All living things are selfish. Everything that's done is for the self, to spread your genes. Cooperation is what humans figured out we had to do to not kill ourselves, basically. And as we can see, it still happens. Yeah, but they will kill other ants. And they're all related. The other thing is you help related individuals. So ants, particularly being haplodiploid, not to use too much technical. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. Okay, and then money seems to drive our society, unfortunately. So yeah, the pens and the pencils and the desks and the paper came from different places, but somebody had to pay for it, and there was a little bit of profit margin involved. Okay. And the letter today, I'll just end with this, because I read the Mercury every so often, and I think it was a lawyer from Arizona who was a buddy of Gabrielle Giffords, and it said, the title was, the whole gun control issue is controlled by the gun manufacturers. And I wasn't aware, I guess there was a law passed during the Bush administration that you could not sue a gun manufacturer for producing a product that killed somebody. So the recent incident in Aurora, Colorado is a perfect example. I mean, there's no, very few needs. Pistols are okay, and this guy made a, you know, I could tell he was a gun owner, and I mean, he said that for the last 60 years, and a hunter. But to have automatic weapons that are made only for killing people, and boy, sales really went up after the Aurora, Colorado thing. How about that? Isn't human behavior wonderful? That's all I have to say.
Thanks for now bumming me out, Tom.
Hi, I'm Yusha Reddy. You know, as I go around all the counties and listen to all the people, and I'm used to working with children a lot, and teaching them conflict resolution from a very young age, it's not that easy because there's a whole family structure at home that you have to work with too. And sometimes nonviolence, as wonderful as it seems, is not accepted by some families because they don't see it as a survival skill. Why are you telling them not to fight? In the real world, they're going to have to learn to do this, this, and this. They're going to have to learn how to stick up for themselves. So there's a contradiction sometimes, even in what I'm teaching, to be right. And then I work with lots of military families, and it's hard to explain conflict and war and guns when that's what's giving them the food and that's what's making them survive in their homes. So it's a very fine line, but at the same time, it can be done, because I know as I listen to everybody on my travels and as I listen to the students in schools, they really want to do nice things for each other. But sometimes they have to break through those barriers of their families and traditions that are set for them, whether it be religion, they're born into a religion, or whether it be a political affiliation. Those are all traditions that they're afraid to break out of because change takes a lot of work, regardless of how small it is. And I think we just have to start slowly and work our way up. But I think we're going in the right direction is another thing I wanted to add as far as schools, too. Thank you.
I think on the dress code, it can go into issues of complexity and scale. We ourselves as individuals might be terribly pure, but are ourselves components of the sentience of the universe, so to speak. But even if we ourselves may be pure, we're made up of billions and billions of cells who are in their own way, though cooperative, self-interested in producing sugar and receiving oxygen, and making sure that everything works together, and largely unconcerned with what might be going on at a bigger level. So even if we are components of the universe, and even if the universe itself might be figuring it out its own sentience through our own meanderings, I think it's perfectly fair that we be worried as dress codes in the same way that we have to be maintain ourselves as components.
In regard to the use of weapons, I can think of no other nation on this planet where people feel the need to carry a weapon as much as they do in our culture. And I would suggest that rather than gun control, we need to have people learn more self-control.
It's going to seem like I'm diverging, but I'm not. I'm bringing it right back to one of Thea's statements about Nishi and the childlike expression, the ability to say yes to something. I like to study conceptual art, and any of you that have some knowledge of art history, you may know that Yoko Ono was a famous conceptual artist before she was the Beatles' disliked wife. She was a famous conceptual artist, and in talking about meeting her, John Lennon described going to a gallery and seeing a piece of hers. The piece was a ladder in a room, and up at the very top on the ceiling was a tiny piece of paper and a magnifying glass hanging. He was invited to climb this ladder, and when he did and he looked up at the word, it said yes. And he said he fell in love with his wife because he, as he climbed that ladder, he imagined that word could have been anything. It could have said, go bleep yourself. You know, it could have been any statement. And when he realized that it just said yes, he felt this incredible love and openness to the person who'd made it.
So much fun. Thank you. Our closing hymn is number 343, A Fire, Mist, and a Planet.
The same warning that I gave earlier applies here, perhaps even more so. The words just keep going. A couple of things I'd point out in the first verse, in the second line, there's a word that is three syllables, and you only get two notes for it. Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, you have to rely on it. And in the second verse, in the first sequence, there's infinite with just two notes for it. So it's infinite, something like that. And then, just keep reading ahead and hoping for the best and catch up with what you can. Stephen, where are you?
Oh,
Dorothy Maver, founder of the National Peace Academy. When major change happens in life, our tendency is to dig in our heels and resist. In these times, may we have the wisdom, willingness, and courage to let go and go with the flow of the emergence of the new story. There's no greater moment of probability for transformation than right now. It's good to be with you again.